I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, and this is an incredible honour for me. The global doyen of rugby league history, Professor Tony Collins, is here with me. Before I say hello to Tony, I really needed some help with this English chapter that we're putting together, and so who better to go to? So, Tony, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me, Michael. Long-time listener, big fan, and I think it's an incredible project that you've undertaken, and it's really a service to anybody who's interested in rugby league history or sports history in general, because Super League was a pivotal moment, not just for rugby league, but for other sports too.
Oh, well, thank you so much. No idea how cool it is to hear that from you. I approach you basically because I wanted some background for the English chapter we're working on, but I thought our listeners would get a real treat out of hearing your thoughts on this as well. So this is an interview that we're going to be releasing as a show, but I'm just going to basically throw random questions at you because there's a lot of ground that I need to cover in this English chapter because, you know, I've done so much on the Australian side of things, but it was a pretty seismic change for English rugby league as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a similar way to Australia, Super League was this kind of culmination of a lot of things that had been brewing for a long time. And I think also, sadly, from a British point of view, it was the final confirmation that when it came to International Rugby League, Australia ruled the roost and nobody was going to challenge that.
Well, that kind of brings me to where I want to start, which is where our story is starting. With 1982, the Invincibles. So anytime you read a history of recent British rugby league, 1982 seems to be this year zero where a lot of stories will be framed around it and everything that happened beyond that and everything that led up to it. And it just seems to me that it holds such an outsized importance in English rugby league, more so than it does from the Australian side.
Yeah, I guess that was possibly because in Australia, because things happened slowly and over time, they weren't as noticeable as what they were in Britain when in 1982. I mean, it was the last tour was in 1978 where the Kangaroos won 2-1. Great Britain pushed them fairly close, but it wasn't clear how far the gap was. However, in 1979, when the Lions toured Australia and got completely smashed 3-0, the writing was really on the wall how far behind British rugby league was compared to Australia. No, but in Britain, because there was no satellite TV, you only saw replays of the matches a year later. You didn't really realise how big the gap had grown. So when the Kangaroos arrived in 1982, it was like visitors from another planet. They were nobody in Britain, apart from anyone who'd been lucky enough to go to Australia, had ever seen players Mal Meninga, Eric Groth, Wayne Pearce. So the shock of seeing players playing rugby league at what was then seen as an incredible level had an impact on British rugby league it's difficult to think of similar events in other sports. In soccer, England had been beaten 6-3 by Hungary in 1953, and this was a watershed moment for English soccer. But, soccer's a big world, and the relationship between England and Hungary was basically non-existent, whereas obviously, England and Australia in rugby league had, in those days, 75 years, now obviously over 100, 75 years of history where, it had been fairly neck and neck, particularly since the 1940s. So to be absolutely trounced and beaten out of sight by a team of supreme athletes who were, you know, all of whom could pass, run and handle the ball like the best three quarters was literally like, you know, visitors from another planet bringing you a new civilization.
And I can't remember where I read this, but some of the talk was, even when Australia were winning, you know, it had been 10 years or 12 years at that point since England had beaten Australia in a series, and for much of the decade before that, Australia were on top. The thinking was always like, well, yeah, I mean, they're winning this time, but we're still the masters of the skill and the beauty of rugby league. And it seems like this was a real watershed where you couldn't say that anymore.
Yeah, I think that was what, because the British team was changed radically for each test match, because the usual excuse or the usual reason that was analysis that was given for the defeat of British teams was that that they weren't playing traditional British football, or that they didn't believe in the British shirt anymore, which is just ridiculous. But yeah, so there was this idea that the Australians are all bash and barge. They may be fit, but they don't have the ball handling skills that British players have, which was, you know, certainly true in the 1950s. But really disappeared. But, you know, by the time you get to the 1960s and you've got players like Johnny Raper playing in the pack, then it's a completely different world. And so, you know, so 1982 was explained by many sort of traditional rugby league supporters by, you know, Britain isn't playing its traditional game. We need more ball handling forwards, tricky halfbacks and things like that. But the reality was that those type of players weren't really being produced by Britain anymore. And secondly, that, you know, it's ridiculous when you think about it, to imagine that you could get, you know, better ball handlers than Peter Sterling or Wally Lewis, for example, as a halfback. So there was a lot of that. And I think that often happens with teams when they're defeated and they don't really know how to respond. They kind of say, let's go back to good old basic virtues and how we've always played the game before. And that was tried, and it just simply didn't work.
And a lot of the talk was also that Australia had brought in this national coaching scheme in the mid-60s, and that had started to lead to this gulf between the two teams. And Great Britain implemented something similar in the years afterwards. But I mean, surely the problems were more fundamental. Like, can you give an account for some of the issues that led up to that?
Yeah, I think it runs deeper than the fact that Australia had a better coaching system, and also, I mean, its coaches were more outward looking and willing to learn from other sports. I mean, most famously, obviously, Jack Gibson and Terry Fernley went to the States in the late 1960s and learned from American football, which is something that British coaches weren't really interested in. But I think there's a whole series of issues that allowed Australia to rise, but also meant that Britain fell back. Some of them are obvious, like the fact that Sydney Rugby League became fantastically wealthy in the standards of rugby league in the 1960s after poker machines were legalised in the late 1950s in New South Wales. And that meant that clubs were much, rugby league clubs in Sydney were much richer. The game consolidated and centralised around the New South Wales Rugby League, and so the standard of playing necessarily became higher because it attracted the best players, particularly obviously from country New South Wales, but also from Great Britain. By the time you get to the 1975 World Cup, you effectively have a Great Britain, probably the best Great Britain 13, is playing in Sydney, but because of the international laws that pertained at the time, they weren't allowed to play for Great Britain. They weren't allowed to play international football. So one of the last great generations of British players, the Mal Reillys, the Roger Millwoods, the Brian Lockwoods, the Phil Lowes, spent the best years of their careers, to a large extent, in Australia. And Britain in the 1970s had to function with what was at best at maybe a one and a half string, second string team. So there was that was an issue. I think the British rugby league obviously suffered economically in the 1960s. In contrast to Sydney, crowds declined very rapidly by the early 1970s. Crowds had were basically an aggregate season crowds were 1 million, which when you consider that 30 years before that they'd been around 3.5-4 million, is a massive loss, both in terms of revenue but also in terms of the numbers of players that were coming through as well. And it's clear that the game constricted in Britain quite rapidly, and that there was a lot of disquiet amongst amateur rugby league clubs about the way the game was atrophying and dying in areas. And that led in 1973 to the formation of the British Amateur Rugby League Association, a breakaway from the Rugby Football League that looked after the amateur game. And I think the other factor that is often overlooked is the fact that football changed fundamentally. Rugby league changed fundamentally in the 1970s. Because of the introduction of limited tackle football. Limited tackle football was introduced in 1966 as 4 tackles, then 71 it became 6 tackles. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the last time that Great Britain run the Ashes was in 1970. The last and only test series that was played, Ashes test series, that was played under 4 tackles. And the generation that played in that match had been brought up and like their football under unlimited tackle rules. I think limited tackle football suited Australia much more than Britain, because obviously to play limited tackle football you had to be much fitter. And you talk to any English player who went to play in Australia in the 1970s, and they were astounded by the basic levels of fitness of even the even journeyman players. And in fact, there's a great story when Malcolm Reilly turned up at Manly for his first training session in 1971. He was shocked to find that the players went on a 10-mile run or something like that, just as a loosener up. And he was shocked not only to find that he came last, but he came behind Ken Arthurson, the secretary of the club then, who was even fitter than Malcolm was. So, there's obviously reasons. The Australian climate is much more, it's better for all round fitness, and different lifestyles, different cultures mean that. But I do think in general that the move to limited tackle football meant that there was a premium placed on fitness, and the traditional British forward skills of passing out under tackle, building up pressure and the ball playing forwards, releasing the backs, you could no longer do that because you only had effectively 5 tackles to build any pressure before you had to lose the ball. And so I think that the change in the nature of the game also weakened British Rugby League, which it never really managed to overcome the gap that had led to, that was manifested by the 1982 Kangaroos and all the way through the 1980s.
And do you think the domestic game was a reflection of what happened in 1982? Was like were the clubs really struggling and the league kind of struggling to keep up as well?
Well, that's the interesting question, because the absolute nadir, the lowest point in the history of British Rugby League, was probably around about 1970, 1971, when the clubs, pretty much all of them were insolvent, technically insolvent. And most famously, Ron Chester, who was a Hull Kingston Rovers representative on the Rugby League Council, said in an interview, "Rugby League is not dying, it's dead." And so it was in a pretty bad state in the early 1970s. And as I mentioned before, Barla broke away to run the amateur game separately because of its frustration at the inability of the RFL to do anything. But things did start to change in the 1970s. And in particular, you have the growth of the rise to prominence of the two Hull clubs, Hull FC and Hull KR, and there was the famous All-Hull Wembley final in 1980, one of a number of All-Hull finals in the Premiership and other competitions that took place from the late 70s to the mid-1980s. And so actually, by the time the Kangaroos arrived in 1982, the British game had actually got back on its feet. It was attracting sponsorship income. Crowds were going up. There was a feeling of optimism in the game that it had recovered from where it had been 10 years ago and was now in quite a strong position. So when the Kangaroos first came over, first arrived in September 1982, there was quite an optimistic sense about how well Great Britain would do against them. And obviously, that's not how things worked out.
But even in the aftermath of that tour, you know, you started seeing these changes being brought in, and again, a kind of level of optimism about, you know, coaching standards improving and the rest of it. But to me, the improvements in the Great British team over the course of the 80s have more to do with the fact that you had, like, Ellery Hanley, Gary Schofield in particular, you know, Sean Edwards, all these players coming through at the same time that, like, by that time, they were already through. They'd already been developed. So were there any substantive changes, or was it just lucky with a once-in-a-generation group of talent emerging?
I think, yeah, you're right about there was a golden generation. Obviously, Ellery Hanley, one of the ultimate greatest players ever to play the game. Gary Schofield, again, incredibly talented. He's in the Rugby League, British Rugby League Hall of Fame, and really deservedly so. Andy Gregory, classic British scrum half. Joe Lydon, great three-quarter. So there was a lot of talent that came through. But as you say, these were people who'd been born in the 1960s and came through. Just, in fact, with the exception of, well, maybe even Lydon, they all made their debuts just before the Kangaroos. Schofield didn't, because Schofield was younger. But they made their debuts pretty much when the Kangaroos, just before the Kangaroos arrived, and certainly in that early 1980s period. But on the other hand, I do think that some of the changes that were brought in with the national coaching scheme that was introduced, and the way that coaches themselves improved, I mean, obviously Malcolm Reilly was a good example of that, meant that by the time we get to the 1990s and the Ashes series between Great Britain, 1990, 92, 94, when they all really went down to the wire, you not only had your Hanleys and your Schofields, all-time great players who would have played in any team, but you also had a bunch of players who, you know, could pretty much hold their own at some level with the Australians, who weren't the most, you know, weren't the greatest players of all time, but they could do the basic things well. So it did have some, impact. But one of the problems with British Rugby League is its ability to sustain effort over a long period. You know, if you look at the way the game has chopped and changed, its competitions, promotion, relegation, rule adaptations, it lacks stability. And I think stability, as any sports and, you know, sports team analyst will tell you, stability is one of the key things that leads to successful teams. And I think that was one of the issues. But also, yeah, I think another fundamental structural issue that led to that imbalance in the 1980s and 1990s was simply the fact that, you know, rugby league is the dominant sport in New South Wales and Queensland, and that by and large the best athletes play rugby league. And in Britain, that's not the case. It's the great example of this is Ryan Giggs, all-time great Manchester United soccer player, one of the great soccer players you've ever seen. He comes from a rugby league background. His father, Danny Wilson, played for Swinton. Great trivia question. When did Ryan Giggs make his first appearance at Old Trafford? The 1986 Great Britain versus Australia test match at Old Trafford. He was a ball boy, because the ball boys were selected from Manchester Rugby League playing schoolboys, and Ryan Giggs was one of them. And he played schoolboy rep rugby until he was 13. Then he had to stop because of his football contracts. Now, if that had been in Australia, we'd have been talking about Ryan Giggs as a really talented soccer player who became one of Rugby League's great all-time wingers. And that was something of a change as well, the fact that soccer almost, in the north of England, almost always won out over Rugby League when you have, you know, kids who were talented at both games in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s. Before that, certainly up until the 1950s, there were advantages to choosing rugby league over soccer if you were good at both games. So, for example, in rugby league, you could get signing bonuses. So when you sign for a club, they could pay you a significant bonus for signing with them, which wasn't allowed in soccer. But in 1963, soccer abolished its maximum wage, which at that point had been £25 a week, something like that, which is pretty much what you'd get as a top-level rugby league player. After that, you know, soccer wages soared. I mean, they're nothing like they are today, but certainly you could earn, you know, two £200-400 a week, when in rugby league, you know, if you could, even in the 1970s, if you got £100 a match, you were doing very, very well. So rugby league also suffered from the way that soccer grew much, much richer than any other sport in Britain from the 1960s onwards. And it meant that, you know, not always, but more times than not, the best when athletes like Giggs, who were talented at both games, had to choose, they chose soccer. So we lost a lot of players that probably would have played rugby league in the 40s and 50s. And yeah, obviously, if they were in Australia, they would have chosen rugby league.
That probably speaks of some of the efforts in the early 80s to expand the game and move into places, you know, like Carlisle, Kent, you know, London through Fulham. Can you speak a bit about those efforts at expansion, why they failed, and, you know, what maybe a different path could have been?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the indications of the fact that the British game was actually on the rise and was gaining support and had a lot of self-confidence in the early 1980s. Because you have a series of expansion teams that are opened, as you say, Carlisle, just north of the traditional rugby league area of Cumbria. Cardiff in South Wales, an area that, you know, the game has always drawn a lot of players from, and, you know, should have had a club there for decades. And then slightly stranger ones, like, as you say, Kent Invicta, which were based in Maidstone in Kent, which is, hundreds of miles from until Fulham, the London club, was founded in 1981. Kent were hundreds of miles from any other rugby league club. And, no tradition. It's a soccer area, no tradition. Fulham themselves, who are now the London Broncos, after several changes of name and location, were founded in 1980. So there was a lot of movement and a lot of optimism about expansion. The problem with almost all of those expansion clubs, the exception being Sheffield Eagles, which were founded in 1984 by Gary Hetherington and his wife Kath Hetherington, pretty much not too far from a traditional rugby league area, just above the board, just below the border between rugby league and soccer in South Yorkshire. And they had a lot of experience and could draw on a lot of, you know, rugby league people from just north of the city. All of the other ones were essentially speculative ventures. They were set up usually by soccer clubs. Soccer at this period was going through a very dark period. It was, you know, rife with fascist hooliganism. Crowds were declining very rapidly. It had a very bad reputation. And so soccer clubs were looking to diversify and generate more income. And rugby league was one of the ways they felt they could do that. So pretty much all of the other clubs were founded either with soccer clubs or played at soccer grounds. So that was a problem to begin with, because it meant that once the soccer clubs started to recover their popularity, the game began to rise. They lost interest in rugby league. Rugby league was a sideline at best. The other problem from the perspective of the game is that there was no plan involved. Basically, if you had the money and you could persuade the Rugby Football League that you could run a club, then you could start a professional rugby league team. There was simply no long-term strategic plan involved in figuring out where the game should have clubs, or even if the game should have clubs in these different areas. And you can, you know, just look at a map of where all these clubs were. It made no sense. There was no logic, no business case, no long-term strategic vision behind that. And so clearly, you know, pretty much all of them failed. Not surprisingly, mainly after one or two seasons. And I think that, in a sense, goes back to the point that I was making about the game on the field, the lack of stability. There's, in the modern period, since the late 1970s, there's really been no stability within the game in terms of the structure of its competitions or its long-term strategic plan of where it's going. And so that means that, you know, there's a new initiative every couple of years. Everybody gets really enthusiastic about it, and then it doesn't quite work out as people imagined, and then they eventually abandon it, go back to the status quo, and then something else comes up. And this has been the history of the game for the past 40 years, unfortunately.
I mean, I can speak for hours on the lack of strategic planning or vision from the Australian Rugby League. But it does seem really particular to the RFL, this going in one direction and then after a few seasons just completely reverting to the other way and being stuck in these endless cycles of, oh, we're doing promotion, now we're doing licensing, and you know, it goes on and on, and it just seems nothing's improved, as you said, for 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's true for a couple of reasons. One, the game has struggled to find, and I think it's probably true in Australia as well, the game has struggled to find top-class administrators who have significant experience outside of the world of rugby league. And in, God knows it's changing rapidly enough now, but certainly even in the 1980s, 1990s, the sports world was changing very rapidly. And so you need that. You need people with that broader perspective about how things have worked out in other sports or in other businesses, other parts of the world. So there's an issue with the type of administration that the league has. The other issue, which again is similar to Sydney in some ways, but even more pronounced, is that the fact that essentially rugby league is a cartel made up of the clubs, and that the clubs essentially make the most important decisions. And you can see that most clearly with Super League over the last year and the Toronto Wolfpack saga, where the decision about whether the Wolfpack should continue, leaving aside anything about the way the Wolfpack was run, but the decision whether the Wolfpack should continue within Super League was voted on by each member club of Super League. And that meant that there was a huge conflict of interest, because essentially the clubs were voting on whether they should get more money from the central funding that Super League has access to, because Toronto Wolfpack wanted their share of the Super League money, which would mean that other clubs got less. And therefore, of course, the decision was inevitable that the clubs would vote to give themselves more money and abandon the Wolfpack, because in their terms, it was seen as taking money out of their mouths. And this has been a perennial problem throughout the history of the game, but it's become more pronounced over the last 30 to 40 years when, the sports world and society is changing very rapidly, and therefore rugby league can no longer rely on its traditional sources of income. You know, crowds that, lived and worked within a stone's throw of the stadiums, players who also had full-time jobs outside of the game, so they didn't demand high wages. And also amateur rugby union, whereby, rugby league by and large could pick the best players that were suited to play rugby league who were in rugby union and buy them up. And none of these things exist today. And the game really hasn't taken any cognizance of that fact, hasn't changed its view of the world and its strategic perspectives based on the fact that its traditional, traditional foundations have changed very dramatically over the past period.
Can you, going back to the early 80s and into the mid 80s, can you explain the rise of Wigan in terms of all of this? Like, what led to them becoming such a great team?
Well, the short answer is the fact they went professional, full-time professional, in, I think, 1985, 1986. All the other teams were semi-professional. Pretty much every player had a job outside of the game. I mean, there might have been one or two star figures, your Hanleys and your Schofields, who didn't work or outside. But pretty much everybody worked outside. In the early 1980s, Wigan were relegated from the First Division to the Second Division, the first time they'd ever been in the lower divisions of rugby league. And that had a seismic shock on the club and the town. Wigan's a very interesting sociological example of rugby league, because although they've got a professional soccer team, Wigan Athletic, it's very much the second choice sports team in Wigan. Rugby league dominates Wigan right across Wigan society in a way that it doesn't in any other town of that size. Not even Hull, although Hull's not too dissimilar, but I don't think there's any town in the north of England where rugby league dominates and is so much a part of the identity of a town as it is in Wigan. You know, you talk to anybody in Britain, say the name Wigan in Britain, and they will say rugby league. And so to be relegated into the second division was a tremendous blow to, you know, civic pride and the pride of the club. The club was taken over by a consortium led by Maurice Lindsay, who is a very model of a thrusting northern businessman. Very innovative, very energetic, very persuasive, and always had some vision, some greater vision for Wigan as a club and for the game as a whole than most people in the game did. So so it was Lindsay took the team into full-time professionalism, attracted the best coaches, Graham Lowe, then John Mooney, attracted the best players both in Britain and Australia. Now, they had Brett Kenny, John Ferguson, Ian Roberts, Steve Ellett, loads of great players playing for Wigan, as well as the very best. He bought up the very best talent in Britain. Ellery Hanley, Andy Gregory, Joe Lydon, pretty much anybody who was available, Maurice Lindsay picked up. So they became, in a sense, if the success story of the late 70s, early 80s were the two Hull clubs, from the mid-1980s, it was Wigan that carried the mantle of rugby league and flew the flag for rugby league in a way that no other club had done, well, quite possibly, going back to before the First World, the great Huddersfield team of Harold Wagstaff and, you know, Albert Rosenfeld scoring 80 tries a season and things like that. And, you know, that's the probably one of the few comparators of that Wigan team of the 1980s and early 1990s.
And where was the money coming from? That's what I struggle to understand, why they were able to do so much more than any other team and get like every good player to come and play for them.
That's a good question. I know for a fact that Hull Kingston Rovers discussed going full-time professional in 1985 when Wigan did it. But the board of directors drew back from it because they thought it would be too costly. Wigan's money came from, primarily from the board of directors. They had a four-person board of directors with Maurice Lindsay and three other quite well-heeled Wigan businessmen on board. So they had access to a considerable amount of money. The status of the club within the town meant that other people, other businessmen would also put their hands in the pockets, as the local phrase has it, to help the club out, to pay the wages of players, to give jobs to wives of players, to supply players with houses at cheap rent, cars and all the rest of it. So there was a pool of monetary and other remuneration that was available to Wigan that wasn't necessarily available to other clubs, certainly clubs in smaller towns. But also, I think the other thing is that in terms of today's finances, it didn't really cost a huge amount. So, for example, I think when Ellery Hanley went to Wigan in 1985, the transfer fee was £150,000. It's just absolutely nothing today. But and for the time, at that point in soccer, transfer fees had already gone through £1 million mark. So it wasn't a massive amount of money, and providing it was controlled, it was probably perfectly manageable. But by the time they got to the late 1980s and early 1990s, it was getting out of control, and it was particularly becoming difficult because of the ground disasters that had happened in soccer in the mid-1980s. The Bradford City fire in 1985, which, to be perfectly frank, could have just as easily happened at a rugby league ground. For listeners who don't know, a stand at Bradford City burnt down in the middle of a match and killed over 50 people. And in fact, Valley Parade, Bradford City's ground, was until 1903, and Bradford City were a rugby league club, and it was a rugby league ground. Then it switched to soccer. So the Bradford City tragedy had a profound effect on rugby league, both because of the fear that it could have easily happened at a rugby league ground, but also because it meant the government brought in legislation pertaining to the safety of football grounds, which, and football on this occasion, did include rugby league football, that meant that most rugby league stadia were in need of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds of renovation. That was followed in 1989 by the Hillsborough stadium disaster in the FA Cup semi-final when 93 Liverpool fans were crushed to death. That had, again, a huge impact on the financing of, the need to make all types of football grounds safer. Rugby League also suffered because of that. And so the amounts of money that were now required by the early 1990s to run a rugby league club did not just consist of player payments and transfer fees. It also consisted of massive capital injections into grounds to either bring them up to the new safety standards or to basically abandon them and build new grounds. So rugby league was hit by a kind of perfect storm. The other thing that happened, obviously, transfer fees, as is always the case in the transfer market, transfer fees just spiralled upwards and upwards. So by, I think, 92, was it? Martin Afaya went from Widnes to Wigan for almost £500,000, which was, that really was a huge sum, given the fact that Wigan also were in the hole for millions of pounds to redevelop their Central Park ground, which they eventually abandoned, put Wigan in particular in very difficult financial circumstances. And they were just the kind of most extreme example of something that was affecting pretty much every club in the game by the early 1990s.
We're jumping ahead a bit, but you've led me to something that I really wanted to talk about, which was, I read the Framing the Future guidelines, and this was the 1996 revision after the Murdoch money had come in. And it was a very different document to what I was expecting, because it seemed like 90% of it was directly as a result of the stadium policy, as you've discussed. It didn't seem it was really a far-reaching guide to fixing rugby league. It seemed like basically a requirement of how the sport could continue.
Yeah, it's an interesting document, and it kind of still echoes today, because if you go to some Super League grounds, you'll find that many of its recommendations are still waiting to be implemented 25 years after it came out. Framing the Future has a long backstory, partly related to the way in which stadiums had to be improved after the Bradford City and Hillsborough disasters, but also it relates back to the way in which the top clubs in the 1980s, Wigan in particular, but also the other leading clubs, Leeds, the two Hull clubs, were looking at the future of the game, in that there was, I think, the earliest mention of somewhat an official saying there needs to be a Super League of the top clubs comes around about 1985, 1986. And the top clubs become frustrated at the fact that they are not getting the slice of TV money that they think they deserve. And they try and reduce the handouts that the clubs lower down in the second division, lower down the league, are getting. Again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier on about the rugby league in Britain being a cartel, where clubs essentially view the future of the game through the lens of their own bank accounts. One of the ways in which the leading clubs thought they could increase the differentiation between them and the lower down the leagues was by insisting on minimum standards for clubs that came into the first division, as the top division was then known. And so there'd been a lot of talk about minimum standards, from certainly the mid-1980s. And so Framing the Future has a long story behind it. And that it's both an attempt to, quite rightly improve the spectator experience at grounds, but also as a way of sealing off the top clubs from having to either share income with the lower clubs, but also trying to make it harder for the lower clubs to get into the top division and, take their share of the top division money, which again is pretty much what was going on with the Wolfpack fiasco last year. So Framing the Future is, there's a lot of things that are highly supportable, and certainly in the In the early 1990s, I was active in the Rugby League Supporters Association, and it's one of the things we campaigned for, because particularly in when Rugby League in Britain was playing in the winter, going to many grounds was not an experience that you could easily recommend to the to a potential new Rugby League supporter. So so Framing the Future both had a good purpose, trying to bring stadiums into the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. But also it played a political role in the way that the top clubs were trying to manoeuvre for a greater slice of the pie and exclude clubs low down the league.
And so along those lines, a phrase you still hear to this day in terms of English rugby league is a closed shop. And we don't really have an equivalent in Australia, because the idea that, I don't know, Wentworthville could one day be playing in the NRL is laughable. But is it a cultural thing about English sport or English rugby league fans? Like, can you talk on that?
Yeah, you're right. It's a cultural thing. It's one of the it's one of the examples which you can see demonstrate that sport is not just a business, that it doesn't follow traditional business lines. Because clearly, you look at the NFL in states, or you know, Major League Baseball, commercially most successful sports leagues, over the past 50 years. And they operate that, closed league system where there's no promotion and relegation. There never has been, and there never will be. And, American sports supporters find it very difficult to comprehend. Now, obviously, in Australia, there's a similar model, because there's no promotion and relegation in the ARL, or the AFL. In Britain, it's different, because there's an expectation that in a league system, everybody has the equal opportunity, regardless of where they start off, that they will play in the top division. So in an Australian context, sure, why can't Wentworthville or any other team in Sydney or Brisbane or in the country, why can't they get to the top of the NRL and play in a grand final? Surely that's everybody's dream. Now, in Britain, that's partly a myth, because it comes from soccer. And soccer started the first league, the Football League, in 1888. And initially, that was a closed league too. And they only introduced promotion and relegation because they did a deal with a rival league, the Football Alliance. And the Football Alliance became the second division of the Football League. The Football League basically incorporated a challenger league, a competitor, and the compromise in that deal was that there would be promotion and relegation between the first what was essentially the Football League and the Football Alliance, but then they were just simply renamed Division 1 and Division 2. But because that took place very early on in the history of soccer, that appeared to be a kind of a model of equality and democracy, that everybody has a chance rather than actually being a business deal. And that became the model for soccer. So then you had, after World War One, you got Division Three, then you got Division Four, then eventually in the 1980s, they opened up promotion and relegation between Division Four and the leagues below that. And so there's an entire pyramid. And that is very much part of British sporting culture, because it's seen as part of the intrinsic fairness of sport. It's a level playing field, and everybody has a chance to play in the final and become the champions. So that's never going to leave British sport. It's so deeply ingrained. And trying to stop that will only result in heartache, pain, protests, and eventually you will reverse that decision and allow some form of promotion and relegation, which is what's happening in rugby league. The licensing came in. There was no promotion and relegation. Then that didn't work. Promotion and relegation was brought in. And this has happened over the last 10 years. So you've got this crazy system where there's about three systems, licensing, the cannibalistic, I can't remember what they call it. I've tried to wipe it from my mind. Bottom four Super League clubs play top four Championship clubs. The loser of the playoff final is essentially made unemployed and all the rest of it. And now we've got what appears to be straightforward promotion and relegation, although that's not how it worked out. So, yeah, so that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, there's a strong business case to have a closed Super League, but the reality is, culturally, that won't work. And it particularly won't happen in British Rugby League, because the game was founded on a principle of equal opportunity for all. That's why we broke away from rugby union, to allow everybody to have the chance to play at the best, the highest level their talents would take them. So to then remove that from clubs doesn't sit well at all with any rugby league supporter. So it's a tough problem to deal with, but it's a problem that has to be dealt with. How do you make Super League as commercially robust as possible, yet still allow a gateway for clubs to advance? And we haven't got the answer to that. Well, the RFL hasn't got the answer to that yet. I mean, I think there are some ways. But it's one of the fundamental issues that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, you had that situation a few years ago where you had Toulouse and Toronto both playing in the second division, and it feels like there's all these complaints about not being able to escape the M62 corridor, and it just feels like, well, this is a big part of the reason, you know, it seemed from an outsider's perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, personally, I think there's a way of doing promotion and relegation simply in terms, going back to a system that Rugby League had in the early 1900s, just have a playoff game between the bottom team and the top bottom team in Super League and the top team of the Championship. And, you know, that solves the problem, because then the bottom team will be replaced on merit, because the top team in the Championship is the better of the two sides. That's difficult for clubs to accept, because because it's difficult for the Championship team. So it's not, and I've had this argument with people, they don't see it as being in their interest. And it's also difficult for the Super League team to accept, because it essentially puts their future hangs on one game. Although that's happened, yeah, you know, that's essentially what's happened in the past. But
with the £1 million game.
With the idiotic £1 million game. But, you know, nevertheless, it's a fairer and less devastating way of doing it than the £1 million game, because you put into place safeguards in terms of funding and all that. I mean, and that works in soccer. It's a slightly different system, but in English soccer, there's a playoff for the last promotion place, which is slightly different, but nevertheless, it seems to work okay. And I think that's what we should be moving to. But you know, clearly, because all decisions have to be made essentially by the clubs, that's very difficult to implement, because there's no one with the authority to say, no, this is what we decided at a strategic level, and this is how it's going to be. If you don't like it, fine, but that's how it's going to be. And that's not something that happens regularly in British Rugby League.
Mm. Just to veer wildly off course, we are rapidly approaching Super League, but I'm not quite ready to get there yet. I want to just touch back on the international game and the advances made throughout, you know, the late 80s into the 90s with, you know, some great series and, you know, going toe-to-toe with the Australians, 1990 in particular. When I think about what was happening with the international game, it also coincided with the birth of State of Origin and that becoming such a dominant part of Australian rugby league and completely wiping out the international game in many Australians' eyes. Because if you wanted really intense, high quality representative football, that's where you went. Do you think a stronger Great British team could have maybe stopped that or curtailed it a little bit?
Definitely curtailed it a little bit, because I think, you know, you look at it historically, then State of Origin has replaced the Ashes as the pinnacle of the Australian game. And it's not an accident that State of Origin started at precisely the time that the British team was at its weakest and its most uncompetitive that it had ever been. As I said, 1979, the British Tour team were embarrassingly whitewashed. next season State of Origin starts and it takes off. And as you say, apart from the great series of the early 1990s, it's never been able to compete. So I think the intensity of State of Origin is basically the modern equivalent of the intensity of Ashes matches. The way in which it's a just a central part of Australian rugby league culture is the same as the Ashes series you talk about. I mean, you go back and look at the Sydney Press or look at Rugby League News in the 1940s and 1950s. Then, you know, if you swapped Ashes series for State of Origin, you'd be pretty much reading the same type of articles with the same type of themes. So a lot of the, perhaps you could say a lot of the credit for the success of State of Origin is down to the poor form of Great Britain in the 1980s. If the Ashes series had have been going if Great Britain and Australia had been going toe to toe in the Ashes series in 82, 84, 86, 88, and Britain had won, and it had seesawed in the same way that it did, in the 40s and 50s, then I think State of Origin would still be massive, but there'd have been two showpiece series within the game, one of which would be the Ashes, the other of which would have been State of Origin.
Great Britain had won that 1990 series. Do you think that would have had a lasting impact on, you know, maybe kind of turning it around? Or do you think that still would have not been enough to address the bigger issues?
Probably not, because there's deep structural issues. I would say that, in a sense, it's completely off topic. The second match of that 1990 series at Old Trafford was the most thrilling sporting experience that I've ever had. I don't know how many listeners actually, because I went there, and because Britain had won the first test at Wembley with a really good team, Schofield, Hanley, Gregory, and against a really good Australian team. And so there was a real optimism in England that this was it. We could really do it. Team was virtually unchanged. We knew we had the beating of the Aussies. And there's a moment in that second test when Australia are attacking, and I think Cliffy Lyons throws out a pass. Paul Loughlin intercepts it. The atmosphere on the ground when that happened, 50,000. There's a lot of Aussie tourists, but pretty much 50,000 British rugby league fans who knew we hadn't won the Ashes since 1970, knew how much the Ashes meant to the game. Loughlin intercepts the pass, goes in and scores. I've never heard 50,000 people take a collective breath of excitement at the same time. Literally, I could feel my chest constricting. I'm sure tens of thousands of other people did. And I think that, in a sense, I grew up in a rugby league household where the Ashes were the pinnacle of our game. And so I suspect that, again, there's another 49,999 people who felt exactly the same. This was not just any old rugby league match with a great piece of skill by Paul Loughlin to intercept. This was the past, present, and future of British rugby league in a moment. And then, of course, Gary Schofield kicks to the corner. There's about 90 seconds left. Schofield does exactly the right thing, as he always did. Kicks to the corner. It's deep in the Australian territory. We've got a draw. We can't lose this series. And then, of course, two tackles later, Ricky Stewart starts to go up the field, up the field, up the field, up the field. Don't get tackled, and we lose. So, I digress. But
that was amazing. That was,
yeah, well, that's and also I remember the first time we ever visited Sydney in around about 2000. I get in a taxi like the second time I'm there, and the guy says, "Oh, you're a Pommy. So, do you follow football?" I said, "Yeah, proper football, rugby league." He said, "Oh, yeah, mate. I remember that second test at Old Trafford. I just couldn't believe what a great game." I said, "You're telling me." So yes, that's a personal memory. But I think it's kind of it shows what was hanging on that match and that series. If we'd have won, I think it would have given the game an added level of self-confidence that it didn't have. The structural problems would still be there. Lack of strategic vision for where the game was going. The problems dealing with the threat from football. And then obviously, you know, financial problems off the field and what would happen 5 years later with Super League. But I think what it would have done, it would have given Great Britain and the British game a new level of self-confidence. Because I think this is the other thing that has affected the British game since the 1980s. And that is, there's a psychological issue. When Great Britain play Australia, there is an expectation that the Australians will win. Because the Aussies are so much better than we are. And, you know, we watch them every week in the NRL or before that in the New South Wales Rugby League. You know, for every great player we have, there are 10 Aussies. And that has an effect on what happens when British players play against the Australians. And that's not to say they're not psychologically equipped for it, or they're not great players, or they're not tough or anything like that. It's just simply the way it is. And I think the classic example of that was the 2003 series, yeah. When in each of series in England, in each of those test matches, Great Britain was winning as the last 10 minutes of the match appeared. And I can tell you from the view of spectators, but I suspect it's also true of the players, is that the British attitude was, can we hang on? Can we hang on? We've only got 10 minutes to go. Which immediately puts you on the back foot. The Australians are thinking, how are we going to win this? What are we going to do to win it? So you're automatically in a different mindset. And what happened? We lost all three of those test matches, which could have easily been won with more self-confidence, better end of game plan. We could have won the Ashes 3-0, which would have been fantastic. One of the interesting things about this this question of confidence is that this is also, or was traditionally true of the English soccer team as well. I spoke to someone who'd worked closely with Frank Lampard, the great English soccer player of the last 20 years. Frank Lampard told the writer that one of the problems the England soccer team had in the 2006, particularly in 2006 World Cup, is that they went on the field and they felt they were weighed down by the weight of expectation and the past. And everybody was always saying, is it going to be our World Cup year? And remember 1966 and all this type of stuff. And he said that, you know, we had to carry that around with us. And there was so the baggage of history was weighing us down. And that, in a slightly different way, is still true today with the Great Britain team. There's a, you know, it's the, and I hate this phrase, but, you know, what is it? You know, it, when we lose, lose well, it's a moral victory. But there is no losing well. There is no moral victory. You lost the game. And that's a difficult thing to overcome. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, I think it would have made, if we had won in 1990, or potentially 1994. And remember, in 1992 in Australia, the British team actually outscored the Australians over the three test matches. So, you know, in a slightly, you know, in sliding doors world, it's not inconceivable that we could have won the 1990, 92, 94 series, which would have given the game a tremendous boost of self-confidence. And I think also what it would have done in terms of the British game in Britain, it would have given it a much higher profile nationally. Because one of the things the game has always suffered from is lack of respect from the national media. But anybody who beats Australia is automatically newsworthy. And certainly to have done it in the 1990s would have had a big impact on the way that rugby league was covered in the media and the attention that it would have got, which would have had a knock-on effect in terms of, you know, public interest, crowds, and things like that. So yeah, it wouldn't have solved a lot of the problems that the game had, but it would have put it on a much higher platform to be able to think about how those problems could be solved.
But you did mention the structural issues. So as we get to Super League, can you just give your rundown on where rugby league was at when Murdoch came knocking on the door?
There's a there's a kind of belief that rugby league was dying when Murdoch came in 1995. That's not the case. The game was in reasonably good health. It had a bunch of long-term problems. Many of which it couldn't do much about. So, as I say, I mean, soccer was outstripping every other sport in Britain by this time, even before the Premier League was introduced. And so, the game couldn't compete for the best athletes who played both games. So that was an issue. Fundamentally, there was the problem of stadiums. The financial hit that the game had to take in order to basically make its stadium safe to play in and to watch the game in was almost beyond its means. It struggled to do that. And as I say, you can go to some grounds today, and I'm not going to mention them because people know which ones, and nothing has changed since my dad first took me to watch the game at those grounds in the late 1960s, the early 1970s. I mean, literally. In fact, they've got worse. So that was a big issue. The other issue was that the game was gripped by transfer fever. Transfer fees went higher and higher and higher, and clubs could not afford ground improvements, high transfer fees. And obviously, when you get a high turnover of players, it's a players' market, so the players expect high wages. So the game had a number of difficult financial problems to deal with. On the other hand, there were some bright spots. It was getting increased TV coverage. It had recruited pretty much the best rugby union players in Wales to come and play. I mean, you know, all-time greats like Jonathan Davis, great players in their own rights like John Devereux, David Bishop, Scott Gibbs, who never really had enough time in rugby league, but was a fantastic rugby league player. And so there were a lot of positive things. So the idea, which I think was peddled by people who supported Super League, that the game was dying and it was on its uppers and it couldn't have done anything different. It wasn't entirely true, but it had dire financial problems. And also there was an understanding that something had to change structurally. And one of the things that came up as a way of helping that and a way of coping with the threat from soccer was the suggestion that the game should switch its season from winter to summer. And this had been, this had been an idea that went back to the 1930s. Lance Todd, when he was the manager, the great New Zealand player and manager after whom the Man of the Match trophy is named after at Wembley. Lance Todd, when he was the manager of Salford, proposed changing to a summer season in the early 1930s. Partly because Salford were competing against Manchester United and Manchester City. And he felt that, well, let's play in the summer and we don't have the same problem anymore. But that became a popular idea in the early 1990s. And I think certainly by the time you get to the Super League discussions, 94, 95, it's an idea whose time has come. And regardless of whether Super League had happened and the Murdoch money had come in, I think the game probably would have switched to summer then. So there's a sense that the game has a number of problems, but people were looking for solutions. There was also queries over the transfer system and questions over whether could the game afford a transfer system and should it move to a system such as there was in developing in soccer that time, where transfer fees became less important because it changed its transfer system. The other thing that happened is that in 1992, the Premier League had been introduced into English soccer through Murdoch money. And so there was increasing calls for a rugby league version of that to happen, partly through selfish reasons of the top clubs, because it meant they could get more TV money, but also because it's seen as an opportunity to try and put the whole of the game on a more professional footing. So there were lots of problems, but there are also a number of ideas that were being floated to try and deal with these structural problems as well.
And The discourse from, I guess, some of the, Maurice Lindsay and the other, club bosses at the time was we had no choice. There were, the money came, that there was nothing we could do. This was the way we were going to secure our future. Is there any argument that they could have resisted the money and tried to go down a different path?
Well, let me put it like this. The last TV deal that the Rugby League got from Sky before Super League was, I think, worth £3.5 million. The deal that they were offered, well, the deal they eventually accepted from Sky 2 years after that was £87 million. So it's difficult to turn down, particularly when there were no alternatives. I don't think that that Kerry Packer was going to fund a rival British competition to that extent. So in reality, there was no choice. Interestingly enough, I mean, there is a story. There is a story which is true from, I know from people who are at the meeting, that the initial Sky offer, the Murdoch offer, was £77 million, and Maurice Lindsay put this to the famous emergency meeting of the rugby league clubs in whenever it was, April 1995, and of course they all wanted to accept it straight away. £77 million, it's, you know, all our dreams have come true. And Maurice, he had slightly more acumen than most people running rugby league clubs, said, no, first law of negotiation, you never accept the first offer. And which is actually a good thing, because that meant that the clubs had voted to accept not only £77 million, but also had voted for the merger of most of the leading clubs in the game. So Widnes and Warrington would merge to form Cheshire something or other. Hull and Hull KR would have merged to form a single team. Wakefield, Castleford and Featherstone would have merged. So there's all these, Bradford and Halifax would have merged. There's these insane ideas about merger, which the clubs actually voted for because they were so desperate to get their hands on the money without realising that it would actually have put their clubs out of business. And because Lindsay said, no, hang on a minute, we've got to, you know, I'm not going to accept the first one because, you know, that's not how you do business. That gave them some breathing space. There were massive demonstrations and protests that broke out against the mergers immediately after it was announced. People, demonstrations were staged on the streets and on grounds. You know, people were protesting like mad. That, you know, that there hadn't been any protests seen in the north of England that was the equivalent of that since the miners' strike of 1984-1985, which lasted a whole year. So there was a lot of pressure from people to push back against the mergers. And eventually the mergers were dropped and the deal was up to came to 87 million. So, no, I don't think they did have an alternative. They could have negotiated better. However, I do think there was a massive opportunity was missed by Maurice Lindsay. It would... I think if I'd have ever been in that position to do this, it was a golden opportunity to restructure the British game for good, simply by saying that this is what the structure of rugby league will be like in the future, and if you want to be part of it, you can have your share of the £87 million. If you don't like that structure, that's fine. You can go and form your own competition. But this is what we're going to do. And I think that's also true at a bigger level of really what Ken Atherton and John Quayle should have done when they were when they're in the middle of this fight. I mean, there's obviously, it's much more complex than that because of the two, the Pack and Murdoch rivalry and the way that rugby league was split between the two. But I do think on an international level, this was, and I hope no rugby union supporters are listening to this, because I'll destroy my credibility as a commentator on the history of both codes of rugby. It was an opportunity for Rugby League to say to Murdoch, look, give us some more money and we'll start an international... Yeah, we can rebuild International Rugby League and we'll start by signing, you know, some of the best rugby union players in the world, and we'll have, you know, a second, maybe third New Zealand team based on the All Blacks. Because remember, a lot of All Blacks like Jonah Lohman began playing Rugby League. Tanner O'Maga played for the Knights. That was a historic opportunity. We could have done the same in Britain and in France if someone had had a broader vision and greater horizons than simply what was going to be the best deal for their particular club. So I do think that, I don't think the clubs had any choice, but I do think the administrators had a choice in the way in which that money was used, both at a British level and at an international level. I think that's one of the great missed opportunities yet again of rugby league, and that its parochialism and its inability to see beyond the short-term interests of its clubs, both in Britain and Australia, meant that it lost some historic opportunities to not only change rugby league, but change the face of rugby in its broadest term around the world.
Leading to the famous quote at the time that some of the clubs had spent the money before it had even arrived, it just seems a lack of that strategic planning and what is this game? What is our future? How are we going to build it?
Yeah. And I think that's because British and Australian rugby league wherever it's played, has the same culture. For a whole series of historical and social reasons, the same problems that the game faces in Britain, the roots of the way the game deals with the problems and the perspective it has on its problems are the same in Britain as it is in Australia, as it is in France. And, you know, and you see in some ways the problems that the game has internationally in Tonga and Samoa with those two teams. Same type of problem, short-term, short-sighted administrators, inability to look beyond their own short-term interests. And the same in Britain as well. Basically, the money was used, by and large, to do exactly the same as they had done before, but spend more on doing it.
I want to go back to the mergers, because it's one of those things that it appears to make perfect sense. There's two Hull teams, we'll make them one. You know, it should work, but it doesn't, just in the same way that South and East should merge here, but they never could. Was it, but clearly something needed to be done about, you know, the structure of the game and what were the best clubs to be in a Super League and where could they expand to? Was there a different way of doing it, of, you know, either coming to mergers or coming up with a different model? Is there a way that you could see that working?
I think you make a good point that on the face of it, if you look at it from a purely business point of view, then mergers make a lot of sense. But again, it comes back to the point you spoke about earlier on about in terms of promotion and relegation. Sport is not just a business. It has a social and a cultural and an individual emotional importance to people that mean that you can't run it as a normal business. I'm a third generation Hull Kingston Rovers supporter. The idea that Rovers would merge with Hull is, you know, absolutely, it's not only it's unthinkable, it makes no sense for the game, because the rivalry between Hull and Rovers is a foundation of the game in Hull, and Hull is, you know, one of the biggest cities that have, where rugby league is, I don't say the dominant game, but certainly the game that defines the city. I mean, there's a professional soccer team, Hull City, which, you know, got to the FA Cup final and the Premier League not so long ago. But the way that Hull people think, if you meet someone from Hull, outside of Hull, and they're quite easy to spot because we have a very distinctive accent, one of the first questions they will ask you is, Hull or Rovers, who do you support? Which it struck me once when I went to first visit to Melbourne, that people in Melbourne ask each other, who do you Barrett for? Obviously, I had no idea what they were talking about at the time. But the idea that you could merge two teams and you're going to have a better team and one that, you know, you're going to have 10,000 supporters from Hull going to see and 8,000 supporters from Hull going to see doesn't work. You're going to have a worse team. You're probably going to alienate 90% of those 18,000 people who go regularly to watch Hull and Rovers. And you're going to set back the game. And the game will lose its only intercity derby, which is a big, you know, it's a big calling card for a sport when you look at your blue ribbon event. And if you haven't been to a Hull Rovers derby, the only equivalent I can think of it from an Australian perspective is State of Origin, in terms of the excitement and the intensity of the experience. So it makes no sense. And to take the example of to merge Castleford and Featherstone, it's the same thing. They're two. The success of the clubs has in some way been built on that rivalry. You know, one of the ways in which you identify as a Rovers supporter is that you're not a Hull supporter. And similarly, you know, if you're a Cast supporter, you certainly have nothing in common with Featherstone supporters. So the idea of mergers, like the idea of scrapping promotion and relegation, it just goes against everything the game stands for. So I don't think that was ever an option. How the clubs for the Super League should have been chosen, I think, is another matter. And that's quite a difficult question to deal with. And it's difficult, you know, especially 25 years to think about how that would have worked out, because we know the story that some of the clubs in Super League in the initial season of Super League, Workington, Oldham, traditional clubs, just didn't make it and are now, you know, sadly not. You know, they're playing in the in League One. They're playing in the third tier of the game due to a whole series of issues. But again, I think. So that sounds like a cop out. I don't know which club should have been in, but I think it goes to the point that there was no strategic vision for the game. If there had been a plan, said, "Look, how are we going to expand the game? Do we even want to expand the game? Because there are a lot of people in the game who don't." And I think that's a legitimate strategy. I don't agree with it, but if you said, "Look, we're going to market ourselves as the Northern sport, and we're not going to be interested in anything outside of our traditional heartlands," then if you can make a strong case for it, then good luck to you. But we don't even have that. So there was no sense that, look, this is where we want to expand to. Do we want to have a team? Yeah, we want to have a team in London. Why do we want to have a team in London? Why was there a team in? Why did Super League have a team in Paris? Not a traditional rugby league playing area. Not really a traditional rugby union playing area, for that matter. I can see there's arguments to have it. You know, have teams in major world capitals, but that's not an argument that was advanced or a strategy that was ever taken forward. I think that's the problem with Super League, that, as I said, basically there was no strategic plan that, you know, here's our plan, we drew it up 5 years later, and then amazingly someone comes up and offers us £80 million, let's implement the strategy now with this money. And so it just led to initially an insanely stupid plan that was never going to work and was tore the game apart, and then led to a plan where we reverted back to what was basically what we'd always done, but also antagonised people because of the threat of mergers, then antagonised Keighley, who should have been promoted to the First Division and who in many ways had pioneered the modern marketing methods that Super League brought in terms of, you know, calling themselves Keighley Cougars, pre-match entertainment, in-match entertainment. You know, it all happened in Keighley before it did anywhere else. And also, you know, effectively stopped teams like Featherstone Rovers have any chance of progressing. So, we basically got the worst of both worlds from what happened.
Seems to me that you mentioned Paris. Paris and that opening night against Sheffield, it's kind of emblematic of what we saw with Super League in the next couple of years. Like, with this big splash and this, we're announcing ourselves, but like the Paris experience over the next couple of years might be the most farcical element of, you know, you could rattle off 20 farcical things that happened in that period, but the way Paris fell apart, like it was just ridiculous. Like what was going on there?
Good question. There's a book on the history of rugby league to be written that's called "What Was Going On There." Super League was presented in a sense. It looks quite good on paper. Super League managed to get the opportunity to create a team in one of the capitals of the world, if you like, Paris, using the identity of a world-famous soccer club, Paris Saint-Germain, and launch the game there. Well, that's a great opportunity. But there's a whole lot of other things that need to be in place. You need to be able to implement that opportunity, and it needs to be part of something else. And you need to think about how the, you know, so the immediate problem is that it's not a rugby league area. I mean, there is a little bit of rugby league, but it's even less of a rugby league area than London is. That's the issue. Okay, so you think, well, no, we're going to have teams in capitals anyway, because that's where the game needs to be and give it a big, big international profile. But there's no plan to do anything else. Then you get down to the nitty gritty, and yeah, I don't want to disrespect anybody here, but it's my understanding that none of the administrators that were sent over to run the Paris club could speak French. And that the only person who could speak French was Harry Jepson, who was a great guy, long-time administrator of Rugby League, lived until he was in his 90s, Rugby League through and through. But, and Harry was, I think at that point, was on the board of directors. And so he was sent over for a few weeks because he was the only person the Rugby League knew who could speak French. So let's be realistic. That's not going to happen. Not least because you can't speak the language, and then also because how on earth can you make anything work, because you just look like, British tourists coming over trying to start something. So it was never going to work. And as you said, then it got ridiculous, and it basically became, within the short order, it became 13 expat Aussies.
They couldn't even get the right visas.
Yeah, I know. And so you could, in a sense, you could see this as a as ambition that overreached itself, which, I think Maurice Lindsay probably took it seriously. But again, it goes to a lack of experience and knowledge of how to do these things. And a lot of trouble could have been saved, and a lot of money probably could have been saved, and a much more long-term future being secured for French rugby league if they'd have included Toulouse or Perpignan, one of the clubs in Perpignan, something like that. But again, we don't really know the full story of why this happened. I mean, the extent to which News Corporation wanted Paris to happen, which they probably did, because the opening night was fantastic. And it was one of these occasions where you think, this is it, this is the future. And it should have been. I mean, that's what rugby league should be like. It should be played in big cities, in front of large crowds with big city teams. And that still should be the goal of the game. Just because it didn't work once, don't mean to say it can't happen again. But clearly, once you start, the reality of it was paper thin. And once something went wrong, then the whole thing started to unravel, to mix metaphors.
But that opening night did kind of set up a season that it seems that there was a lot of optimism and a lot of signs that it was, that it was going to actually happen.
Yeah, there was the opening night, and I think the other thing that, and actually I'm not sure whether this is the first or the second season, the other thing that I think made you think something could happen here is when London Broncos played Paris Saint-Germain at, I think it was Charlton Athletic Soccer Ground, the Valley, and the kickoff was delayed because of the number of people that were trying to get in. And to imagine that can happen in a rugby league match in London, and this was a match between London and Paris, showed you that it actually, things could happen. And this is the tragedy of it, because I think that, there are in rugby league, a lot of people think the game can never expand. We've tried it before. It's never going to work. Let's just rein ourselves in and we'll just play M62 Corridor and Cumbria. But, I think that ignores the potential and the possibilities that have been demonstrated time and time again in the history of the game. Another example I always think was good was 1995 World Cup, when England played Wales in the semi-final at Old Trafford. There's something like 15,000 Welsh Rugby Union fans there. It was like being at a Welsh Rugby Union International, the singing and everything. And again, you thought, there's something going on here. And so, the classic example of where that was capitalised on was France in the 1930s. Similar type thing. People went to an exhibition game, were obviously blown away. Fortunately, they had structures in place and a lot of determined people who understood how things worked in France to make it happen. And that's what was lacking in the 1990s. There were lots of examples, I think, where we could have made a breakthrough. Super League could have been, could have helped to do that. But we didn't really have, to hark on about it, a strategy to capitalise on that. Or the wherewithal, the know-how, how to lead a major sport forward in, you know, in an era of rapid change in the sports world.
So is it fair to categorise your assessment of it on, there weren't any like glaring mistakes, it was just a like festering mediocrity in the administration and the way the game was run. Is that a fair thing to say?
What, you mean in terms of what Super League offered?
Yeah, in terms of Super League starting strong and then just not really going on with it.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I think, again, I think because what really happened was that, with the exception of the Paris thing, basically the same thing happened, you know, as I said before, the same thing happened as before, but with the difference that they spent more money doing the same thing. I think two things, kind of side points. I think the fact that the protests of the fans changed the direction of Super League was very important because it reminded administrators in Rugby League of who the game really belongs to. And it demonstrated how passionately people still felt about Rugby League and what it meant to their local communities and how they saw the world. And that, you know, that essentially hasn't really changed since, you know, 1895. The other thing that I think was important was the switch to summer. Because I remember when the discussion first came up in the early 1990s, I thought, well, yeah, but is it going to change anything fundamental in the game? And in a sense, it didn't. However, it did make going to rugby league matches much, much more enjoyable. And I say this as a veteran of standing on freezing cold night, standing on terraces on freezing cold winter nights where by the time the game's over, you can't feel your feet or your hands, where matches are cancelled because the grounds are too hard, because it's too foggy, because snow started. So to stand on the terraces, or even to sit, if that's your thing, on a warm, yeah, I know this doesn't happen very often in Britain, but on a warm summer's evening, and watch the game being played on, you know, decent pitches, where players, you know, aren't, you know, weighed down by mud, and where they've got the opportunity to display their skills in, yeah, in the best surroundings is really great. And I think that, you know, that has been something that has changed the game for the better and probably fundamentally. I mean, although there are still people who want to go back to winter, I don't think that will ever happen. I don't think it should happen. And it also managed, I think, and it managed to give the game breathing space because in the early years of Super League, the late 1990s, early 2000s, the game was under pressure from rugby union because many in rugby union, particularly in Welsh rugby union, thought, because Rugby Union was now professional, as it went professional in 1995, same time as Super League, they thought, great, it's payback time. We can go and buy up all the best Rugby League players just like they've been buying up our best players for the last 100 years. And I think if we'd have been playing in winter head-to-head, I think we would have probably lost more players because a lot of players did go and play in the winter for Rugby Union clubs because of the amount of money that was offered, Robbie Paul, Gary Connolly, players like that. If we'd have gone head-to-head with them in the winter, I think we'd have lost more. They would have probably gone permanently and you'd have had more Jason Robinsons and Andy Farrells going. But as it was, then, you know, we came out of that fight, you know, relatively intact. If we'd have lost more players, I think then that would have led to a greater crisis of self-confidence and more media pressure. So I think some, you know, inadvertently, the switch to summer rugby also had an impact on the struggle with rugby union.
Just to finish up, I want to come to, you know, the present. And is it as bad as it seems over there? Like, how worried are you about the future of rugby league in England?
Well, one level, I'm not worried at all because, you know, the game survived through 126 years of adversity, economic collapse, depressions, wars, pandemics, and all the rest of it. And it still survived. And it went through Super League War, where people, you know, I said people demonstrating on the streets, people weren't talking to each other. And so the game will always survive. The game will always be played. I think the question is, how successful will it be? And I think that's another matter. The game has not been able to come to terms with a lot of these structural problems. So, for example, the north of England, the where rugby league is strong, the place where rugby league has its foundations, has been hit terribly hard over the past 40 years by deindustrialisation. There are no mines there anymore. There are hardly any factories. There's certainly no textile factories. You know, and it was mines and textiles that were the majority of rugby league fans and supporters came from. There's no, there are no docks where, you know, a significant portion of players and fans from Hull came from. There's no heavy industry anymore in the north of England. So yeah, we've lost the foundations of the game. Since 2008, since the great financial crash in 2008, the north has become much poorer and much more deprived. So it's the case that if you look at, of the 10 British Super League clubs, sorry, well, 11 now, 11 British Super League clubs, I think 8 of them are in the most deprived areas in the whole of Britain. So you've got a game where its strongholds are in the places where the market can't really expand because people are just too poor, too impoverished to spend in the same way that they can in other areas of the country. So that's an issue. I think another issue, going back to what I'm saying about Welsh Rugby Union, although there are some great Welsh rugby players playing the game, including Regan Grace, sorry, his name, forget me, I'm getting old, Regan Grace at St Helens, Ben Flowers. There are some great Welsh rugby players. We can no longer have the pick of the very best Welsh players because obviously there's more money on offer to them. So we've lost a significant pool of talent that we'd had for the last 100 years before 1995 and Union going professional. So we've not really come to terms with Rugby Union going professional either. So we have a problem where the heartlands are weakened and the opportunities for us to gain players from traditional areas have also been weakened. And of course, when areas are impoverished, it doesn't mean not only they not go pay to watch the game, they also really can't afford to play it. And there's been a decline in sport in British schools for a long time. So there's a number of structural issues which the game really hasn't come to terms with, or at least come up with answers to. Then clearly there's a question of structure, promotion and relegation. How's that going to work? What should the top level of the game be? Does it have an expansion policy? Who knows? I mean, there was a... Again, I don't know the full details, but there was a commission that was set up to look at Toronto by Super League, which decided that there was no market for... Because there was no market for International Rugby Union in Toronto, there was no market for domestic rugby league in Toronto. So we don't... which is just crazy. Again, it was an excuse to get rid of the team. So we don't know... So there's been no real serious strategic plan about do we want to expand the game? If so, where do we want to expand it to? So there's a whole series of issues that resolve. So I don't think the game will die. I think the problem is that unless it comes up with some answers and a coherent strategy for the future, it will just stagnate. And it will carry on pretty much as it is now. And what that will mean is that it will constrict, not just in terms of expansion, but it will constrict and contract in its heartland. And I think one of the reasons for that is because rugby league, for people who are rugby league fans, and for people in the north who aren't necessarily fans, but know about the game and respect it, rugby league brings something different. It's both intensely local and community-based. So it says something about you either as someone from the north of England or... For a lot of people outside the north of England who are rugby league fans, it says something about your kind of relationship with society, that you're not really mainstream, that you might see yourself as a bit of an outsider, a bit of a renegade, a bit of an outlaw. It's a different type of sport. You're not really part of the national scene in a way that it has a kind of credibility to it. And so if rugby league doesn't grow and doesn't try to stake its place on the national scene and the international scene. That idea that, you know, it's rugby league is a way of saying to the world, I'm different. I'm from the north of England. I'm a bit of a rebel. You know, I'm going against the grain, which is what every rugby league fan has in one way or another. That will start to decline as well. And I think, because one of the great things, stop me if I'm starting to ramble, one of the great things in the 1990s, or 1980s and 1990s, when rugby league could sign Welsh players like Jonathan Davis, was that this was really the game saying, look, you may look down your noses at us, rugby union, the media, the establishment, but we're capable of standing on, you know, standing up for ourselves. We can give as good as we get. We are, you know, we're not going to back down. And that, you know, that which is basically the story of rugby league, that if, you know, it's if it had a back down, it would have gone under a long, long time ago. But you have to find ways of expressing that and expressing that essential nature of the game. And that there's a lot of ways of doing that, either through, you know, those type of signings, which did it in the 1990s, or by offering a you know, showpiece game, showcases that really, you know, lay out the lay out what you can offer, and providing an alternative model of sport for the in, you know, in a British and international market. And I think that's, in a sense, again, leaving aside the problems, internal problems of the Toronto Wolfpack, Toronto Wolfpack actually marketed themselves in Toronto as a different sporting experience. And I think that's something the game can replicate around the world. And I think, you know, because it's rare where you can find top-level professional sport where, you know, it's a look, it also has that intense sense of community and locality. I mean, you know, with the best one in the world, you don't feel that if you're a Barcelona supporter. You don't feel that if you're a New York Yankees supporter. But in rugby league, you know, we're not the same league as that, but in rugby league, you do get that. So it is appealing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's managed to spread to countries like Serbia, that it kind of expresses something about, and Lebanon, it kind of expresses something about, you know, how ordinary Serbians feel about the world, or how ordinary Lebanese people feel about the world and their place in it. And that's what the game has going for it. I think that's what we've got to, that's what the game has to figure out a way of capitalising on, but also structuring the game so it can make the most of that and build on its, you know, build on its strengths and solidify itself for the 21st century.
Wow, that's a great note to end on. That was, you know, brilliant words. This has been amazing, Tony. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure our listeners are just going to be blown away by the last couple of hours, because I certainly have been. So, you know, and I also want to take the opportunity to just thank you for all you've done with your work over the years. It's certainly been very formative for myself. So, yeah, it's truly an honour to have spent this time with you.
No, likewise. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. I want to thank you for inviting me and giving me the chance to talk about this. And I think, you know, it's... what you do with the podcast is fantastic, because it's giving people who either, you know, live through the history, or old enough to live through the history like me, or people who don't know the history too young, gives them a sense of where the game's come from and how it has survived. Because, you know, by all rights, it, you know, there's several times when it could have died, and perhaps, you know, it you know, logically in business sense, it should have died, but it didn't. It survived. And I think that's the amazing thing about the game, that rugby league, you know, there's all sorts of problems and there's all sorts of things that everybody would change. But fundamentally, I think what keeps it alive is the fact that it's seen as, it offers something different to other sports. As I said before, it was founded on a principle of equal opportunity. And I think that wherever it's played, and regardless of the ineptitude, corruption, or just sheer stupidity of some of the people involved in the game, that's what always comes through. And I think, you know, rugby league in Britain is in a weak state at the moment. It probably will get healthier because, you know, there are enough people involved who want it to get healthier. And I think that fundamentally what it offers on the pitch and what it offers on the pitch put it in a good position that, you know, just because it's failed in the past doesn't mean to say it's going to fail in the future. And I think there's going to be, you know, there's a lot of changes in the sporting world. There's a lot of opportunities. And I think there's no reason to think that eventually we're going to capitalise on one or two of these opportunities, as we are doing in the Pacific, and maybe we can do the same thing in the rest of the world as well. And you know, the game will eventually fulfil its potential. So thank you. Yeah.
I really hope you're right about that. No. But yeah, thanks again, Professor Tony Collins. This was a real treat. And with that, we will speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.